Welcome to the Pepin Podcast, a research into practice conversation between pre-service and in-service teachers and teacher educators about research and practice. For episode 14, I'm joined by one pre-service teacher, two in-service teachers, two university teacher educators and the author to discuss James Rudd and colleagues' 2021 paper, An Ecological Dynamics Conceptualization of Physical Education, Where Have We Been and Where Could We Go Next? From Physical Education and Sport Pedagogy. We begin with an around-the-table discussion. Over to you, Cam.
Okay, so I agreed with a lot of what was in the blog, but I also thought that I don't think we need to completely discount skill acquisition. I think the acquisition of skills just for having them, as in just for having the skills like in the locker, yeah, that might not be important, but the process that we go through to acquire those skills can be important and be productive, whether that be through a model like cooperative learning or something else. It's the process to go through can still be valuable the process to go through to acquire that skill can still be valuable, more valuable than the skill. I also thought I was reading it thinking this is quite a big issue, a school-wide issue anyway. Like, there's a lot of what you do in English and, let's say, languages that you might never use. But again, coming back to it's the processes that you go through to get that knowledge that is really applicable in life and afterwards. But also this, like, it is a system that everyone's gone through. You know, still talking about the whole school issue. Everyone's gone through it, and I like to think a lot of people have managed to adapt to the real world. Obviously, there's tweaks there to be made, but it's not completely ruined everybody over the last however many hundred years. And then finally, I think there are spaces for sort of structured five-a-side games and gymnastics. Because, I mean, that's the enjoyment side of it for a lot of pupils. I've lost count of the amount of times this week I've been asked by pupils, so we're doing a proper game this week. I appreciate for some pupils that's not valuable and they don't want to do that. But equally, why discount those that want to do it? It's about making it sort of attractive to everyone. And then also on the gymnastics front, I think that is something that can be done like for like in real life, especially stretching. Like, it's stretching, and if we then pull it into yoga as well, it's quite good for everybody to have that in the locker and to see the value of that and do it as you would do it. Like, I don't think there's a much difference in how you would teach sort of stretching and gymnastics in school and the value for it to what you do out in the real world to keep yourself mobile.
This paper made me think of what I studied at my undergrad. So, like, experiential learning, and I think it was Colin Mortlock back in, like, the 70s or something, had this misadventure theory, which I think, it's basically you learn through your mistakes. So I think that's sort of, that's what I got out of it. It was sort of leading towards a more experiential experience. So children would go and experience something, and then from what happened, they'd learn. So it would be more like self-learning as opposed to a structured environment where you'd teach skills. But then I was sort of thinking, you surely need, that with the swimming example, you need to learn in a controlled air environment before you're thrown straight into the ice-cold lake. So I think by doing drills and by doing the structure that we have in PE, you then learn, as Cam says, the motor programs and stuff that you can then adapt and use to different situations. And then the last sentence that says, as highlighted throughout this paper, adopting and even going as far as replacing education with exducere, or however you pronounce that, long-term aim for PE becomes one of leading out and encouraging children to engage in physical activity beyond the school setting. I'd sort of think they're the same, education and the fancy word. Because you can't lead someone to do something without them having some form of education or knowledge on what they're doing. So at some point you've got to implement that education so they can go forth and learn from their misadventures.
Yeah, I'll jump in if that's okay. I'm kind of looking at this paper from some two point of view. So as a teacher, but also as a head of department, sort of designing a curriculum. And the biggest thing for me was that idea of leading out, because I feel like with a curriculum, we are trying to design or have something in place that is going to sort of give pupils something to hang their hat on when they leave us, whether that's in year 11 or whether it's in sixth form. And I just thought the idea of leading out to the environment is really, really quite refreshing, because then there's not pressure on me to try and dictate where that may be. There's no pressure on me as a head of department to say we must put this in our curriculum now, because this is to lead out. The idea of sort of the ecological approach is for pupils to interact with their environment. In order for them to do that, they're going to have to experience it. So now, in terms of my curriculum design, I'm not thinking about what activities or what things we can do to help you learn some basic skills, or to learn some team solving a problem or some exploration skills. And just actually thinking, now, how can I actually show you your local area? How can I get you to explore the school in a different way, and what you use every day? Because if my normal curriculum would be football, rugby in the summer, athletics, cricket, some fitness. But are those boxes, are those activities, are those curriculum areas ticking the boxes of varied experiences, or are they just, again, the similar thing that we have, which is a sort of a bank of activities, a bank of things that we assume will transfer to the real world? And when you teach groups and you teach them football, and you teach them rugby, there's no guarantee that some of the things we think that will come out from these sports will transfer. So the other thing for me is just leading out and experiencing. So in terms of our curriculum, looking at what local parks can we visit. I spoke to my form class actually today and said, does anyone know that Dagenham Park, which is literally 5 minutes from our school? And they said no. So that's 30 boys who don't know. 5 minutes down the road, there's a huge forest park with about 100 deer roaming free. They've never been there. And if our curriculum doesn't think about sort of letting them explore what's in their local area, for some of those boys, they will never, ever know and never go to that place. So, for me, obviously, I recommended the paper. So it resonates with me a hell of a lot, because it gives me a little bit of, okay, I'm not trying to prepare you for said sport or said activity, but I'm trying to give you a little bit of an idea of exploring your environment and the value in that, the value of just exploring where your local area. And then hopefully, you never know, 10 years time, someone might be like, oh, I remember going to this park, and they go there with their grandparent, or they go there with their mum, their dad. Like, the dream for me would be to walk past that park and see 20 of our boys over there with loads of equipment just playing, because we went on a trip there, it wasn't a trip, it was actually just part of our curriculum. Every year, every week, or every other week, we go to the park and we do the same things we do in school, but we just do them in the environment that's local to them. So yeah, that was a massive thing for me. And then the second part, which I really resonated with me, is that nonularity, I don't even know if that's a word, but we all know that when you teach, pupils don't learn in a linear fashion. So why do we continue to teach in a linear fashion? And why do we put pressure on ourselves to assess in a linear fashion? And why do we not just try and embrace the complexity and the sort of randomness of it? But with an ecological approach, for me, it gives me an idea, but okay, I'm not just doing things for the sake of doing it. I'm not just doing random things. I'm not being sporadic. I've actually got some purpose to it. And I think that's something that if anyone's sort of exploring this approach, they need to really look at. If you're looking at it from a lens of what you normally do, then it's going to seem like the other two guys have just said, like, well, they need to learn some skills in order to be able to do some things. But if you're looking at it from a different lens of for me, I've written here, the journey is the thing. It's not to necessarily say that you're having a journey, you're exploring, and you don't have a purpose. There is a purpose, and there is teaching involved. There is structure. There is all of the things that we would associate with being a teacher, but it's just a different way of teaching. So yeah, it's a massive. It's massive for me, because it completely changed my mindset on how I would look to develop a curriculum. And then I don't know if I can carry on for a second, if that's okay. But in terms of like as a teacher, so I'm teaching sporting skills, and if you are deconstructing and sort of taking apart skills, which is what we normally tend to do, then technically you're not teaching the skill anymore. And that's something that's really resonated with me. And you could, for 5 years, you could go through teaching fundamentals of certain movements, but you'll see it a million times. People will self-organize to what they can do. They will adapt to the situation the best they can. And I think if we can run with that and use that rather than trying to fight against it, I think we might have more joy.
Great. So I looked at this paper from, you know, a couple different lenses, you know, where are we now and where should we maybe be going in PE? And certainly a lot of what the paper had to say in this ecological dynamics framework made me pause to reflect on my own teaching in PE and the purpose and the greater worldview that teaching movement skills, you know, has behind it. You know, as we all know, the, you know, multi-activity sport model in PE has, you know, is really fraught with many limitations. And I thought the paper and the research behind it dealt another large blow to that traditional approach in PE that we are so accustomed to being a part of and being around. And having the reflection from my own personal perspective in providing the tweaks that can bring about a better change in an urban setting, I think this paper brought home a lot of those points. One of the things that I think was interesting is taking the skills and movement patterns and bringing them into the real world and connecting that real world community aspect into everything that you do around it. Because if our purpose and mission is just simply teaching skills, content, and you know, this hard pedagogy that we're accustomed to being around, then are they going to actually apply that? And will they actually, you know, in the long term, meet the long term goals that we want for our students in the future of lifelong physical activity, movement, skill acquisition? So I think I looked at it in a different perspective. Instead of bringing the community into the school, we need to bring the school into the community and connect that relationship a little bit more directly, so that students can overtly see how what we're doing in physical education can connect directly to outside activities, public parks, recreational activities, partnering with organizations to be able to facilitate that learning. And the one size fits all approach and PE really leaves no room for, you know, SEL, adaptation within your planning, discovery, inquiry. Those are the connections and the deeper connections that students, you know, yearn for, especially in this difficult time in our world. And if we don't provide that for students, I think we're doing a grave disservice for them. And I believe that the ecological approach certainly gives us pause for reflection. And, you know, traditional methods of content delivery in PE have such a narrow scope and a narrow lens with teaching sports skills, teaching movement patterns. I think we need to open that up. And the predetermined criteria that we are so accustomed to falling under with our linear patterns really needs to be looked at in a different approach, because students' brains aren't hardwired like a computer. We are in this randomized, you know, setting that students learn from more of a holistic approach. And if we assume simply that poor practice in teaching is simply because we're not connecting with the students in a certain way, I think we need to reflect on the 30,000 foot view and have a different perspective on how we plan and implement the real world curriculum that needs to be delivered for physical literacy at the end of a student's career.
I'll pick up where Michael left about leading children out. I think one of the problems we have is that a large minority of children don't see any relevance in PE. And I think part of that problem is adults try to draw a very clear boundary of what PE is to make it relevant. And in that process of trying to make it relevant at an adult level, I think we make it less relevant for children. And the ecological purpose that is put forward in the blog in James's paper, I think takes that boundary and blurs it. It makes it porous. And not only do we need to think about how we lead children out into the community and the movement cultures and the physical activity in the community, it's reciprocal. We need to think about what the community is doing to bring into our PE curriculums. And that's what I really love about the blog and the paper. And now I'm going to bring Clancy in.
Thanks, Alex. Hard shoes to, or hard foot steps to follow with everyone's poignant words. You've captured it all quite well. Cam, Charlie, Mo, fantastic. Michael, wow. And of course, Alex, always another level. So, you know, many of my thoughts have already been stated, but I will go back to a couple things to reiterate. Research or in my past, I've been very intrigued by ecological dynamics because I really enjoy the games-based approach when it comes to physical education and for that matter coaching. And so in my earlier years, and kudos to James for his fantastic paper as well, but in my earlier years, I used to equate both together quite often. I used to think, "Oh, this is really just ecological dynamics is really games based. It's tactical games. It's TGFU." And yes, there are a lot of similarities. But in my years and my seasoning, I've realized there are differences and nuances. And I think that's what Ash and James point to in the blog in the article, and namely that. You know, games-based is still about improving the final product, whether it's tactics and strategies and those types of things, where ecological is about the journey and what we do within that journey, the process, the systems theory that James refers to. That's what I've learned over the years in terms of the nuances and how it's different and the ecological dynamic approach is different. The affordances and how that practitioner, the physical educator, constrains those circumstances accordingly. But I want to kind of center on what Mo mentioned too, because it's something that I outlined in my notes that, you know, children don't learn in a linear fashion, and we understand that, and Mo is right on, and in a lot of ways we've gotten that right, and I can speak to that, you know, that idea here. You know, I think about my days as a high school student, as a rugby player, grade nine rugby players. We had a grade nine rugby team. We had a junior rugby team. We had a senior rugby team. Grade nine rugby players. Anybody who was in 10th grade that had a birthday from September through to January could still play grade nine rugby again, considering, again, the development of a child. The conditions of that he or she may face. So we've gotten this right in a lot of ways. But Mo asks a great question. How come if we understand that maybe a child who's born in September can be held back and join kindergarten 1 year later, why can't we apply this to when we teach? You know, and think about, instead of always the end result, like Ash points out, we think about the journey, not A to B, but A and the journey, the inquiry, the discovery that goes with that. So that's what I garnered from the blog and from the article, James, and thanks.
Okay, over to you, James. You get to respond to all of that first.
Where to start? Wow. Like, it's, first of all, Ash, you're right. It's fascinating, isn't it, hearing what people think about your writing, and not just my writing, the writing of my co-authors as well, who I can't be here today, but we're all very keen. So first of all, big thank you, and yeah, it's so much to take away and take in. I guess I'll start with just why I wrote the paper, or wanted to write this paper. And it comes from my own experiences working as in PE and as teaching PE and teaching it in a primary school setting. And when I said primary school, sort of elementary school. And the main thing I found when I was teaching, my lessons were always quite episodic. I would aim on trying to teach them certain skills, create certain games to teach those skills, and then hope. But what I always found is my lessons weren't connecting towards each other. The development of the learning wasn't there. And no matter how many times I told them or showed them how to do things to do them, it just didn't quite feel right, didn't quite connect. And what I always was amazed by is how much more engaged, how much more into the task they were sometimes in the playground or in these kind of unstructured play environments in which they created for themselves. And it just got me to thinking about, well, what do I currently know about skill acquisition or how we learn skills? And that took me down this rabbit hole of, first of all, this idea that we acquire skills, and to acquire skills, we have to teach them. Okay, so we are going to be passing on our knowledge that we know, or how we do things, to others. And that was, again, certain ways in which you can do that. But then I came across ecological dynamics. And it's no longer about acquiring, but it's about understanding the symmetry between the individual and the environment, and actually the importance of the environment in how that shapes and develops skills. And that's not just talking about the built environment, that's the culture, that's all other aspects. So this is all embedded. And if we are trying to teach skills in isolation of all these other factors, we're not going to get very far. But if we start to take this more understanding the symmetry between the environment and the individual, and then that takes you down this garden path of, well, okay, well, what is their environment? Where, what kind of world are they currently navigating? What pieces of equipment do they have at home? If I ask them to bring their equipment into school for early primary schools, what some will bring balls in, some will bring a handheld computer game. I guarantee it's those ones who have brought the balls in who are going to play more at lunchtime, be more active, because that's the world they're currently navigating. So it just, I guess my one thing is around skill acquisition. Maybe we should start thinking of it more as skill adaptation to the environment, and taking our role away from being a teacher of those, but a learning designer, someone who designs environments and connects those environments, which is with the worlds they're currently navigating. We're more likely to see lead out for children to be physically active beyond our P, which is ultimately our goal. And I'm not saying, one thing says, oh, you don't think sports, we shouldn't teach sports. No, we should, like, but because they create constraints. Gymnastics, different movement skills will emerge there. Dance, different movement skills will emerge. And we want to give them this broad vocabulary to explore these environments. Now, I could go on, and there's loads of aspects in the paper to cover, but I'll stop and then, yeah, pick it back up if time allows, Ash.
Yeah, I mean, it's, if you've only read the blog, as I've always say, you're always picking up my interpretation of it. So there is a lot more in the paper. And there's a, you know, I'd encourage everybody to read it, in that sort of respect. But as always, I get a chance to kind of respond to these things, and I'm not sure where to start. But I guess I'm going to pick up I've written it down twice, so I'm going to pick it up twice. I've written beef down. And I've written beef down because it's an acronym that's used. I don't know if it's used in the US, but it's used in the UK. Everyone's doing it. There we go. Balance, elbow, eyes, follow through, all those sorts of things. And it takes me back to standing and teaching the layup. It's not beef, it's not the layup, but the layup. And, you know, setting a cone up and approaching at approximately 45 degrees, and approaching and doing this beautiful layup where you post the ball onto the edge of the envelope and it drops into the thing, absolutely fine. I don't think in 15 years of teaching I ever saw anyone do a layup in that way. Because it doesn't happen like that. You're out, you're off balance, you're under the net, you're not quite in the right position, I used a different approach when I was teaching where somebody would have to stay shooting. So they'd get into position, they'd say shoot, and then the game would stop. And then from wherever they were, they had to then proceed to do the skill. For those who were high ability, they didn't even have to say shooting, they just had to get on with the layup. But those who were lower ability had to say, and they stopped the game. And from wherever they were, and what you found out is they're in a completely the wrong position every single time. And actually, it's very rare that unless it's a fast break that somebody actually gets to do a layup in the way that we teach it. And so ecologically, even in the game of the basketball that we're playing ourselves, beef does not work. Because actually, when you're doing a set, you're actually here trying to pull and your elbow's in completely the wrong position. Your eyes aren't underneath the ball and there's no sort of process. And I guess that kind of struck me twice in the discussions that we were having that even some of those, the things that we know when we teach and we love don't necessarily put us in the right position to do what it is that we, you know, we want. And I'll go back to Cam. So I think it is important to teach how to do things. But we've had this discussion before about teaching games for understanding. What comes first, the game or the skill? And what often comes first is the skill. So we lay it down, and as Mo, I think it was Mo said, or I can't remember, it could be Michael, the skill is not the skill when you break it down and teach it. Beef is not a skill, it's a technique. The skill and that comes into the game itself. So it's making that decision about what, how you apply this, even with the context of the game that we're playing. And you see a lot, I mean, I love cricket, I obviously mentioned it in here. And they do practices deliberately where they have to hit the ball as far as possible in modern cricket. And they literally do throwdowns and they are literally trying to hit the ball as far as possible. And yet we don't necessarily teach that in cricket in schools. We teach this beautiful high-elbowed forwards defensive that you know, you don't play very often, particularly in modern cricket, the type of cricket that these kids play in clubs. And I think Alice's point about adults defining what relevant is, and I think that's a really, you know, interesting process. And actually, I was doing a lecture today on action research for the postgraduates, and we got into this situation of top-down implementation, and the national curriculum is a top-down implementation. This is what you should know. The NASPE standards are a top-down implementation of what should happen, but it's adults defining what is relevant. It's adults defining what should be taught, and it's not necessarily kids defining what should be taught. But kids would choose lots of different things. Most of them wouldn't choose rugby or cricket or football or basketball. They would choose to chuck a ball around in the park, or they'd choose to play on their Xbox. And these are the confines of what we have to do. And there's so many ways that we could talk, but I do think there's some relevance there in terms of what we do needs to be relevant in the world that we live in. We don't even let kids go to the park on their own anymore. So, because that's a scary thing in itself. Where's my child? I'm going to stop there. I've got loads of notes, but I open it up to everybody now to jump in terms of, finishing it off. I'd like to finish by, say, 2:45. So we've got loads of time to sort of talk around the point. So particularly Cameron, Mo, Michael and Charlie in the first instance, but let's see what comes back from there.
I'll jump in then if you want. With the relevance thing, who's to say what is relevant? Like, by that definition, you could argue that all subjects have relevant topics and irrelevant topics. I remember when we were learning trigonometry, we'd always question why we were doing it, and the response was usually, oh, my brother's a joiner, he does this all the time, I don't want to be a joiner, so why? That's not relevant to me. I guess we could, on that logic, we could question the relevance of anything in PE.
And I think that's a good point. And when you define a curriculum and you examine the curriculum and you assess it, and you define that knowledge is important, then that's why you have to, and that's where the difference. So you'd have to change the education system, Charlie, in quite a lot of respects, I guess. But sorry, Mo, I think I've still talked straight over the top of you then.
No, it's fine. I was going to say, like, yeah, 100%, Charlie, I agree with you. I think when you are in a sort of a position as I, what goes in my curriculum, then you really, I think you have to strip it back and think, okay, so why are we doing what we're doing? Because if you don't know why you're doing it, then the relevance is sort of irrelevant in a way. That I haven't got any clue about why we're actually doing it. Are we doing this because we normally do this? Are we doing this because we think this is what the kids want to do? Are we doing this because this is just my bias and I like this sport and activity? And that's kind of where historically where PE's been some of the time. It's like people coming in liking these things and putting them on, and we've always just done them. So I kind of just looked at it as like, why are we doing these things in the curriculum? And the honest answer was because my old head of department used to do it. I didn't really know how to put a curriculum together, so I took that one and just changed the badge from Royal Liberty to so on. But I kind of didn't want to carry on. And if anything has made you think about what's relevant now, COVID has been the biggest eye-opener in terms of your PE curriculum. Like, when everything's been stopped, so organised sport and so forth, it's really hit some people hard, and it has hit the boys really, really hard. And I just thought, if this was to happen again, has our curriculum really prepared people to be physically active outside of school? Because this is what they've had to do for the last year. They've had to, we can put on fitness activities, we can put on HIIT sessions, we can put on online lessons, but you're technically asking them to come back to the computer to work out and to be physically active, which is, blows my mind anyway. But I kind of realised that if we can design a curriculum that allows people, or not allows people, that's the wrong word, but gives pupils sort of a bit of understanding of how they can interact with their environment, whatever that may be, I think we're on a path to try and help. It's never ever going to be perfect. Like, there's going to be 100% some activities and some things that we do in our curriculum which is sort of based on an ecological approach which kids won't like, but that's where the co-design comes in. And I think that's a huge thing, and I know you've done a lot of work on this with sort of, and other people have as well. But we talk to the boys now, so the pupil voice is now not just a once a term, but it's a constant conversation. How did you find today? What did you like doing? What would you like to do next lesson? An example of what's relevant. So today I had invasion games. What are we doing, sir? I said, what would you rather do, handball or football? I think I'll do handball today, sir. That's a really quick win, and I'm not sure that's entirely an ecological approach, but that co-design element of it gives that relevance. But if you haven't got that embedded into your curriculum, then there's no room. And like sort of James has said, it's narrow. If you just keep sports on your curriculum, in my opinion, then it's narrow. Whereas if everything's open, then you can find relevance. But if you've only got sort of two options to look for relevance, then that's going to be quite difficult for you to do.
I'd want to say that relevance isn't a euphemism for letting the children do what they want. Although their voice is important, I think, to find out, we still, as PE, we're the professionals and we need to make professional judgments. Relevance is about what the local environment, what the local community, what the local culture can afford the opportunities for them to do. So I'm originally from the Southwest. It's relevant on some of the schools on the coast in North Devon to offer surfing and water survival, because that is relevant to the community that they're in. That's not necessarily children choosing to do what they like.
Yeah, I mean, I'll pick it up there with Mo and Alex. I mean, Alex, you bring up a great point. Different communities and different spots around the country and around the world have different cultures, traditions, and that really dictates the approach that we can provide our students and our pupils going forward. I think in the complex, you know, systems approach that, you know, James had highlighted in his paper, I think the ecological dynamics perspective defines and affords students to have multiple ways to create solutions to the same issue or the same problem that we have, and whether it be skill acquisition or a games-based approach. And I think the two mirror each other, but I think, you know, obviously the environment connects the ecological dynamics approach a bit more than a straight games-based approach. And students of all skill levels in the ecological dynamics approach are now afforded multiple means of expression using their affordances and connecting that with how they attain success. And I think effective teachers can adapt the spaces and the gaps and the manipulatives and objects and obstacles to create an environment that encourages discovery, inquiry, inclusion. And when that happens, it's nonlinear. And that's when students become engaged, and students that become engaged, you now have the opportunity to impact them for the rest of their lives because you created an environment that they can connect to and that they can achieve success after they leave the school.
Thanks, Michael. I really like that. I really connects with me, and is it, you really articulate a lot of the key points from the paper. It's the movement, and to be honest, movement learning theory, what it allows you to do is explore how children learn through movement. And there are two schools of thought on this, as I cover in the paper. But the one of the key differences between the two, and if we go from an ecological approach, it stops us looking at things through a deficit model of what the kids do not have, okay? To more understanding, well, what do they have, and how will, through interactions with the environment, potentially can we, it will afford them something, and we should respect that. And what we see, that movement solution may come, is where they're currently at. And we can start to, it takes off the pressure, it takes away this kind of ego-oriented mastery of skills, of this idea we have to learn fundamentals first, to more going, well, okay, a child in a wheelchair can explore, discover, be afforded many opportunities alongside another child, and it could probably have better physical literacy, shall we say, because they sit, attune, identify, come up with different ways in the environment than a child who stands there and looks to the teacher and goes, what do I do? Then that environment's not offering some of them anything. They're not afforded any opportunities to move. So we're trying to lead out, and there's a number of layers to that. We're trying to lead them out to explore and engage and interact and find their own ways to move through those environments. And leading out into the, ultimately, it's out into beyond the school gates, but it could be, why do we teach year seven and we're already focusing on the after-school clubs? Come on, come play in those clubs. Could we not lead them out into a playground? Could we not go, okay, we've just come to a brand new school with all new kids. Could we not now be going, well, actually, if we can get them physically active for that 45 minutes a week during lunchtime, well, actually, that's going to really have a big impact on their well-being. So maybe leading out, and our task simplification, or where we're aiming, is to create a year seven curriculum around playground games. we're exploring, we're seeing what they're doing currently. What is that ecological niche of that playground? What's going on? What are the games being played? Can we educate children to engage in those games? Can we, so kids don't choose to go and sit in the classroom or in a lunch hall, but to be have an active time during, is having, it gives you that flexibility to explore these things, which I think is so important. And then the next year, they're doing that, that's when we start leading them out into our other opportunities. But it gives you as a PE teacher flexibility to explore these things. And it's contemporary understanding of how we learn to move. It's what we currently understand from, yeah, the field of movement sciences. So it's just, it's a wonderful journey to explore. Yeah, so that's a little bit from me.
Add to James and Michael's point really quickly, and, you know, taking on this type of approach, exploring, as James points out, it allows for meaning. And, you know, we've talked about meaningful PE over, you know, a few of the podcasts, and relevancy, Alex and Mo bring up, you know, that's what it's all about. And if we can do that, we also get closer to individualizing learning and engagement with each PE student as well.
One quick example, if we've got time.
Quick.
So our curriculum, sort of playground curriculum, looks like this. It looks like tag. Every year group plays tag. Massive games are tag around. We've got building work at the moment. And our warm-ups are starting with tag every single game. You look across the field, tag gets up and running within 2 seconds. I don't need to stand there and lead a warm-up because they've been playing it for the whole day anyway.
I mean, that's a great example, and you just have to realise that when I teach tag as well at the university, and sometimes we're allowed to get close to each other, but it's not called tag in Ireland, it's called TIG and IT, and there's all sorts of different names. So that's a really interesting cultural thing in terms of relevance to what, you know, these games actually mean. And I think there are challenges here. So, James, I'd love to have a conversation with you outside of this about what this actually looks like in practice. So, you know, I'm editing a book series at the moment. It's looking at praxis, and it'd be interesting to see what this actually looks like for teachers to pick up and use. I love the idea of the playground, but who designs the playground? Can't the kids design the playground? If the kids actually designed what the playground looked like, then they'd lay down the games that they wanted to. They'd draw 3 stumps on the wall. They'd draw 2 sets of goals. They'd draw a hopscotch pitch or whatever. And I think, you know, challenging them to design, you know, this is a blank slate. How, you know, here's some paint, go and design what you want to be on this space, and let them, you know, engage in that process. But I think one of the real challenges here is that, and Mo, you can't talk back to this, so I'm just going to say it. Every year group is different. Every class is different. In a model that takes on this approach, you cannot have a unit of work. You can't have a scheme of work. You can have an aspiration in terms of what happens, but you're changing that process. Or at least you can have a start point, but then everybody starting from a different point. How do you challenge the most able? How do you challenge all the highest achieving? I don't like the term ability, the notion of who is currently higher achieving and who is lower achieving at the time. And I think there's some real challenges around that. I think it's a brilliant place to be, but you need to have the confidence to let things go in different directions. And every class is going to end up in a slightly different space, and they're going to have a slightly different way of getting there. And it's going to be about relevance. And I think busy teachers with the demands in the curriculum, this is not always an easy place to be in. And that's why we need, I think, as researchers, we need to help people to understand how this actually works. And we need to talk to individuals in a language that they understand. And I think theoretical papers are really useful and really good, but at some point it needs to be practical examples as well. And that's a criticism of lots of people, and also a kind of a challenge to lots of people to make this, all these sorts of ideas usable. And I guess that's part of what this blog's about. Podcast, this, isn't it? It's what the blog and the podcast are about. So huge thanks, James, for your work. Thank you. I really enjoyed reading it. Thanks, Mo, for the suggestion. Huge thanks, Cameron, Alex, Michael. Charlie and Clancy as well for being here, and we'll call it quits there. And that's where our discussions ended. I'd like to thank Cameron, Charlie, Michael and Mo for their insights as teachers, and Clancy and Alex as teacher educators and James as the author for lending their thoughts to our discussion. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and hopefully you'll choose to catch up with us next time when we talk about refugee background young women in grassroots football.